let's look at Psalm 49. We're spending some time here in the second half of the summer looking at various psalms. And here is an odd psalm. Maybe it's one that has stood out to you in the past. Maybe as you read it with me, you'll be like, wow, I've never really noticed this one. This is an unusual psalm. One way I'll mention that this is an unusual psalm is that it's not a prayer and it's not a worship song. It's more didactic. It's a wisdom psalm. If you notice, you're not talking to God as you work through this psalm. Most of them you are. There's another psalm I'll reference a little while later on. Psalm 73 is very parallel in many ways to Psalm 49. But for now, I'll just say Psalm 49 is a wisdom psalm. And I want you to notice as I begin it that the most distinctive thing right away is that not just the psalms, but most of Scripture is addressed to the people of God, to us. It's not talking to people outside of the people of God, not directly. But this is not only talking to the people of God, it's talking to everyone. It's not just talking to the poor, but to the rich. It's not just talking to the religious, but to the secular. It's not just talking to people who believe in the God of Israel, but people who don't even pay attention to the God of Israel. It begins with, "Hear this, all peoples. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high." Whether you live in Queens or the Bronx, or you live in Manhattan, pay attention to this. "Rich and poor together, my mouth shall speak wisdom. The meditation of my heart shall be understanding." And here's kind of the key for going into the rest of the song. "I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will solve my riddle to the music of the lyre." So there's a riddle that the rest of the psalm is going to solve, and it's going to solve it to music, to poetry, not with philosophy and abstract thinking. Question: why should I fear in times of trouble when the iniquity of those who cheat me is surrounding me? When those who trust in their wealth and who boast of the abundance of their riches, truly no human being can ransom another or give to God the price of his life. For the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice. That he or she should live on forever and never see the pit, the grave, the cemetery. Because he sees that even the wise die, the fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. Everything people are focused on, trying to accumulate, trying to accomplish, in a moment, it's going to be gone, and it's just going to be left to others to do with whatever they want with it, and you're going to get no say in it. This is a theme that often comes up in wisdom literature. Their graves are their homes forever. Almost certainly, this is playing on, if there's anything that's true about the rich throughout all of history, is they own a lot of property, and yet this almost points out that the only real estate they permanently have access to is the cemetery plot they're buried in. That's the only real estate that will be attached to them long term. It is the only dwelling place they will have for all generations, even though when they were alive, they called lands by their own names. The only piece of property long-term is the cemetery stone with your name on it. Human beings in their pomp will not remain. You can translate that word pomp, prestige, glitter. These are people who shine in the eyes of the world. They look like winners. They look like success stories. And yet in their pomp, they will not remain. They are like the beasts that perish. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence. And yet, this is part of the problem. After them, people approve of their boast. They're popular, they're influential. People think, oh, that's the right way to live. Look how well they're doing. And yet they're fools. There's a riddle here. There's a problem here. Like sheep, they are appointed for Sheol, just an ancient word for the graveyard, for the cemetery where the dead are buried. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol with no place to dwell. Almost certainly, this is the key verse of the psalm. We'll come to it in a few minutes. It is the only verse in the psalm where God is the active subject, where God is doing something in the psalm. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. So, be not afraid when a human being becomes rich. When the glory of his house or her house increases, don't fret, don't be envious, don't be shaken by that. Because when he or she dies, this person will carry nothing with him. Their glory, their honor, their pomp, their prestige is not going to go down with them to the grave. Because though, even while he lives or while she lives, They count themselves as blessed, as one of the winners, one of the successful. And even though if you get praise when you do well for yourself, his soul will go to the generation of his fathers who will never again see light. The story's over. Human beings in their pomp, yet without understanding, are like the beast that perished. This is an interesting psalm. One of the ways I'll go into this, let me see, what? Oh, here it is. Here are my notes. One of the ways I'll go into this is that not just as Christians and as religious people, almost all human beings have some sense that like death is a problem. And it really is. I don't want to deny that. But one of the ways to put what's so interesting about this psalm is that death is a strategic help to those who have faith here. That knowing something about death actually helps you to navigate the world and not be as impressed, not be as thrown off by the kind of fictions that are out there socially in the world, that this person in Psalm 49 actually uses the universal fact of death in order to build his confidence and not be shaken by what today we would call something like peer pressure. And so let's look at Psalm 49. At the very beginning, and I think in the bulletin, I called this sermon a riddle resolved in rhyme. I'm lying there a bit, and partly this will help you with the Psalms in the future. One of the things that is very distinctive about Hebrew poetry, which the Psalms overwhelmingly are, and other parts of the Old Testament are too, is that not only do the Psalms, does Hebrew poetry not rhyme, although that can be true for modern poetry as well, Hebrew poetry has no meter to it either. And so it's almost unrecognizable to us as poetry, because poetry for us in the Western world tends to rhyme, or at the very least, always tends to have meter. So when I say it's a riddle resolved in rhyme, what I'm really saying is that the context that this psalmist uses for inviting us to think about it is not an Ivy League lecture hall to go listen to a philosopher. It's not a TED talk. It's not listen to this debate on social media. It's not just think in your own heart. It's step into the sanctuary where we are singing, where we are celebrating, and notice what looks different from this perspective. In Psalm 73, if you want to turn there real quick, because we will turn to this psalm a couple of times to see parallels. Some of you will remember this. Psalm 73 is better known. Psalm 73, the first half of it, I'm not going to read much of it today, is focused on the same problem. People who don't honor God and love their neighbor so often seem to be the winners, so often seem to be what you want your life to look like. And people who love God and love their neighbor, often things go wrong for them. And this really bothers me as someone who has faith. Psalm 73. And he even says, similarly to Psalm 49, that he says in Psalm 73, in verse 21, he says, when my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart by this problem, by this riddle, I was brutish, like an animal, and ignorant, I was like a beast towards you. This idea that we get reduced to being animals is also in common with Psalm 49. But just to say, the turning point in Psalm 73 is in the first 15 verses, you get the problem. And then in verse 16, he says, but when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me to be a wearisome task. By the way, something that both Psalm 49 and Psalm 73 have in common is that they're clearly related to the book of Ecclesiastes. If you want to really jump into Psalm 49 and Psalm 73, have Ecclesiastes open next to it. Just that everywhere there are dead ends in life, everywhere there are things that slip through your fingers when you think you've understood it, or think that you've grasped it, or think you've accomplished it. And here the idea is, I'm pondering, how does this make sense if God exists, if my faith is true? And it just seems to me like a wearisome task. I can't figure it out until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then my eyes were opened and I discerned. Here is something I want to name for you. If you've been a Christian for a while, or even if you're just exploring in this season, I noticed this when I became a Christian in college. I noticed this very early on, and I wish I had language for it sooner in my life. And I don't think it's unique to us as Christians, but it is important for us to be aware of it. Have you ever noticed that things make a whole lot more sense on Sunday when you're spending time with other Christians worshiping, listening to scripture? And then by Tuesday, you're like, how was I even a human being who could look at the universe like that 2 days ago? Like, the world has changed. What is imaginable and unimaginable is often very different on Tuesday and Thursday than it is on Sunday. Context, atmosphere, even your friend group. If you are around really affluent people, a really comfortable social setting all the time, there will be beliefs about the universe that will be easier for you to believe there than if you are around people who are in poverty all the time. If you are around poverty and brokenness all the time, there will be beliefs that are easy for you there and beliefs that are very difficult for you there. That would be the opposite if you were in affluence. Context matters for how you see the world. And so the psalmist is saying you need to come into God's presence and sing and worship and celebrate that this is not primarily an obstacle or a problem for the philosophers. And so going back to Psalm 49, I want you to notice, if you didn't as I read it, is that it uses language of foolishness, of not having understanding, even of stupidity. He says in verse 10, not only do the wise die, so do the fool and the stupid alike, they perish. There's a lot of language here that's very critical of, let's put it this way, the majority view in any given moment in history, that this psalmist believes, and this makes him a bit of a sectarian, that the majority opinion in any given moment is profoundly stupid in a fallen world. That there is a lack of understanding that is the status quo in every moment of human society. That's very frightening to think that that might be true. It's also something that's very liberating. The most obvious one is this. I was going to say this later. I'll say it now. There was a book in the 1970s by a German sociologist and anthropologist named Ernst Becker that won the Pulitzer Prize, and it's called The Denial of Death. And the thesis statement of the book is very simple, that the most characteristic, unique aspect of modern Western culture, what most sets us apart from every other group of people in the history of the world, is that we not only don't pay attention to death, we actively deny it in a way that is unprecedented. The elderly are in homes. Funeral homes keep dead people off the streets. You can walk through life and never have to encounter death until it sneaks up at you at the very end. And that is unprecedented in human history. There's an old joke, I don't know who came up with it, but I found it insightful, is that for those of you who remember reading Charles Dickens and Jane Austen and all these old Victorian kind of British writers, that in Victorian culture, 1800s, that there's this joke that people were obsessed with death, but that sex was taboo. You don't talk about sex in public. And somebody made the joke that we're the exact opposite today. We are obsessed with sex and you're not allowed to talk about death. We're like, what are you going to do? Go to a party on Manhattan on Friday night and bring up that, hey, did you guys see the Barbie movie? There's that line. She's like, hey, have you ever think about the fact that you're going to die? It's like, just, it kills the mood. Right? Like, we don't talk about this. And in not dealing with this fact, this universal fact about human beings, the psalmist says a profound foolishness, a profound lack of understanding, a profound stupidity descends upon the social dynamics of every culture. I don't want to pick on ours. This is true of every culture. There was, and I'll send this around later if you want to read it. I highly recommend it. About 4 months before he was arrested by the Gestapo in 1942, at the end of 1942, right around Christmas, he was arrested in March of 1943. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote a letter to three of his friends who were co-conspirators in the Valkyrie plot against the Third Reich, against Hitler, and he would eventually, in a few months, be arrested for this, spend the last 2 years in a Gestapo prison in a concentration camp, be murdered. And he wrote this letter to three friends. It's called After 10 Years, in which he says, for 10 years, we've been trying to get the body of Christ to come back to their senses. For 10 years, we've been trying to get the German people to not go down this foolish, unbelievably stupid road. And 10 years later, it looks, humanly speaking, like we've been wasting our time. And he reflects in this letter on what they've learned from this. And there is a section in the letter. I'm just going to read you a short section. I will bring this out for you because, as you all know, 2024 is going to be an election year. And there will be a lot of stupidity in the air and a lot of paranoia and a lot of anger and a lot of just unreality and people getting really frayed and really kind of thrown off their balances. And this will be relevant there too, but I think it's relevant in Psalm 49 for this dynamic. Here's what Bonhoeffer says to his three friends. Stupidity is a more dangerous enemy of the good than malice. One may protest against evil and injustice. It can be exposed. It can even be prevented by the use of force if necessary. But against stupidity, we are defenseless. Neither protest nor the use of force accomplishes anything here. Reasons fall on deaf ears. Facts that contradict a stupid person's prejudgment. And as you'll hear, he doesn't mean stupid here in the sense of low IQ. He's even going to say some of the smartest people you will ever meet are profoundly stupid. So he means it in a moral sense. Facts that contradict a stupid person's prejudgment simply need not be believed. Does that sound familiar? In such moments, the stupid person even seems to be a critical thinker. And when facts are irrefutable, they are just pushed aside as inconsequential, ignored, and treated as incidental. In all this, the stupid person is self-satisfied and also being easily irritated becomes dangerous by often going on the attack. That's a great description of social media. For that reason, greater caution is called for when dealing with a stupid person than with a malicious person. If we want to know how to get the better of stupidity, we must seek to understand its nature. This much is certain. Stupidity in its essence is not an intellectual defect, but a human defect. There are human beings who are remarkably agile and gifted intellectually, yet stupid. And others who are intellectually dull and simple, yet anything but stupid. And so if you're in your heart either rooting for this, like, oh yeah, let's bring the stupid people down, or thinking like, I can think of three or four people in the room who really need to hear this right now. Here this is potentially aimed at each of us as well. That there is an aspect that Psalm 49 says that all of us left to ourselves will be as dumb as animals, at least with respect to some things, unless we come into God's presence and really pay attention to reality. It would seem... He goes on to say, the impression that one gains is not so much that stupidity is a congenital defect. Some people are just born stupid. That's not it. But that under certain circumstances, people are made stupid. Or rather, that they allow stupidity to happen to them. It's a very frightening, very critical perspective he has here. And again, I hope that you hear this. Bonhoeffer is not being self-righteous and arrogant. He's just saying that this is a huge problem in human society and each of our lives, potentially. The process, and then he says, it would seem that stupidity is perhaps less a psychological than a sociological problem. And this is something that Psalm 49 says. It is about the influence of the crowd. The influence of dynamics in society that as you experience them and as you respond to them instinctively rather than thoughtfully, that the long-term trajectory is that people get dumber because of the crowd. Mobs make people dumber is what Bonhoeffer learned during his life. The process at work here is not that particular human capacities. For instance, the brain suddenly atrophy or fail. That's not it. Instead, it seems that under the overwhelming impact of rising power, you notice who's got money, who's got power, where it is, and you either like it or you're worried about it, that you begin to respond to it in a way that is not wise. Humans are deprived of their inner independence and more or less consciously give up establishing an autonomous position towards the emerging circumstances around them. The fact that the stupid person is often stubborn must not blind us to the fact that he is no longer independent. In conversation with this person, one virtually feels that one is not dealing at all with a person, but with slogans, with catchwords, and the like that have taken possession of him. Does that sound familiar? I see this all the time. This person is under a spell, blinded, misused, and even abused in his very being. Having thus become a mindless simpleton, the stupid person will also be capable now of any evil, and at the same time, incapable of seeing any longer that it is evil. This is where the danger of diabolical misuse lurks, for it is this that can once and for all destroy human beings. Now, Bonhoeffer saw that in his life, and I'm not saying this is exactly what's going on today, and I think this dynamic is always happening in every moment of history, and then he ends by saying this, yet at this very point, it becomes quite clear that only an act of liberation, not instruction, can overcome stupidity in a person's life. Only an act of liberation, not one more Ivy League degree, not one more TED Talk. The word of the Bible, that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, declares to us that the internal liberation of human beings to live responsibly before God in God's world is the only genuine way to finally overcome stupidity. That was a long excerpt. I want you to turn back to Psalm 49. I think that's exactly what this guy is doing. He's saying, pay attention, all peoples of the earth. There is a form of stupidity that is the status quo in every culture of the world, and we need to wake up to it. And what he sees is this. And so there's only going to be two parts of this sermon. One, what's the riddle? And two, what's the solution? The riddle is pretty obvious. It's in the first part of the psalm. The riddle is this. It's not what we would today call the social construction of reality per se. It's a particular kind of it. But to say this is that every human culture teaches us to value certain things and not care about other things, to desire some things, to be indifferent towards other things. And what the psalmist sees is that not only does what our culture teach us to value, this person who's wealthy, I hope I'm in their favor. This person who has power, that's the good life. This person who owns lots of properties, has lots of houses, that's who I want to be like. And also this fear that I hope these people don't turn against me. But there's this idea that this entire socially constructed world can only arise, can only make sense experientially if you are committed to ignoring death. If you are committed to ignoring that death is coming for all of us and that none of us can ransom ourselves from it. That every emotion of envy you will ever have, you are envying someone who will be in a grave for most of history. Every moment of fear towards another human being you ever have, you are fearing someone who is utterly helpless before death and unable to rescue themselves from it. You are when you are worried about someone, or you're like, oh, if only I could be that person, you are envying or fearing or responding to someone who is not to be envied in any way, who is in a very precarious position. And so the problem is, why then do in the people of God, and I don't want to be condescending here, I feel this all the time, and I'm convinced every single one of us feels this, why are we so affected by peer pressure then? Here's something that I want to encourage you, even after the sermon, we'll have a couple of minutes to just silently reflect. All of you, if you have any self-awareness at all, know that there are certain things Christians believe that, at least here in Manhattan, here in New York, it's different in other places in our country, different in other places of the world, but there are certain beliefs Christians have that it's actually to your advantage that you believe this, because you're expected to believe this as a good person in our culture. And there are other beliefs Christians hold that you are worried about holding, or you are worried about someone knowing that you hold them because of the estimation they have in your eyes. You fear them. You are afraid of them. You want their approval. And in, I think one of the keys to this psalm is in verse 13, he says, even though this is the path of those who have foolish confidence, caring about wealth, caring about power, caring about the approval of the crowd, yet after them, people approve of their boasts. People who make a lot of money, people who are on the front page of newspapers and magazines, people who raise their voices very loud on social media, and you can just get the sense of like, whoa, it would be like, you know, I don't want to just, like, how much conviction did that person say that with? I don't want to, like, get into the mess of that. That people change how they believe, they let their conscience be formed by it, and they get shaken away from trusting in God because of the social dynamics at play here. And yet these social dynamics would not exist unless we were all ignoring death. And so I forget who it was, whether it was Max Weber or whether it was Emile Durkheim, these two great sociologists, but one of them said that one of the most basic things you need to know about every human society, every human group in the history of the world, is that social facts are things. And what he meant by that is that if I pull out just a very basic example, if I pull out a $5 bill and a $20 bill, it's just a piece of green paper that has the number 5 and the number 20, and yet it will be treated differently by other human beings because we've agreed as a group that this one's worth more than that one. That he's pointing out that even though we're constantly making things up in terms of values, in terms of trajectories, in terms of dynamics, that once it happens in a group, it begins to exert objective influence on the people in that group. Every one of you, including me, if we are aware and if we're willing to be ruthlessly honest, there are things that we react this way or we react that way. We fail to react or we overreact, not because we think it's true, or good, or because there's any independence coming from the inside, but because we know this will gain me favor with these people, this will keep me away from the pushback, from the antagonism of other people. This person notices that I want to trust in God. I want to live my life before God, obeying his commands, and I am constantly shaken by the haves rather than the have-nots in society. I notice people who trust in their wealth and boast in their power, and I think it is more important that I'm in the good with them than I'm in the good with God. It is more important that I avoid their wrath than I avoid God's anger. It is more important that I become like them than that I become like my Creator. This is something that we need to be ruthlessly honest with ourselves about. We almost all, not just as Christians, but I think as human beings, almost all of us have the self-narrative, the autobiography, where I have chosen my beliefs on the basis of reason. I've chosen to think and to feel and to look at the world because I'm looking at the evidence and I'm making a decision. And Psalm 49 says, BS. That's not what we're doing, at least a lot of the time. We are responding to the crowd. The crowd is getting the people of God to be shaken by this. Psalm 73 says the same thing, that the very people who are boasting in their power and who are trusting in their wealth often have a more practical influence in the life of the people of God than God does. And this is a problem. This is, why would I care so much about this? And so I do want to encourage you, don't look away from this dynamic in your life. I want to say this again. I'm not trying to shame you, because every single one of us struggles with this. Every single one of us struggles with this. If you've never read it, an essay, you can find it online, an essay by C.S. Lewis called The Inner Ring, I would highly encourage you to read. This desire we all have to be on the inside rather than on the margins, to be a successful, popular person rather than a despised person, not to be sneered at and scorned, but the glittering gold like other people and the influence that exerts. I think the Apostle Paul was a really good pastor, not just a really good theologian. And so pastorally, I want to follow him here. He says that his role in Ephesians 4 is to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ. It's one of the reasons we gather every Sunday, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Why? Well, here's one reason: so that we may no longer be children tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every latest fad of doctrine, by human cunning and by craftiness and deceitful schemes, but that rather, speaking the truth in love, we might grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. When we talk about different beliefs or convictions or behaviors that we might or might not think we're supposed to engage in as Christians, it is easy to step back and treat it as if we're just debating whether the Bible teaches this clearly or not. And that is a good thing to do. We should do that. What Psalm 49 reminds us is that so much more than that is usually going on below the surface in why we form certain beliefs, why we opt for certain lifestyles and trajectories, why you pursue this career rather than that career, why you're willing to speak up about this, but you stay silent or embarrassed or even change your mind on this. You are not, James K. Smith has this great line, you are not a brain on a stick in those moments. You are a human being with desires who really wants to be popular and who really doesn't want to be unpopular. Now, that's the riddle, that this exerts a profound negative effect on the people of God in being faithful to following God, in obeying his laws, in reflecting his image in the world. And so the question is, what's the solution? And I hope it's beginning to make a little more sense why he pursues the solution to the riddle in rhyme, in poetry, in singing. You have to come into the presence of God in the sanctuary with his people. And as we celebrate, as we hear his word, as we're reminded that this is reality, that the perspective that we get in the body of Christ, things can begin to not just look different, but feel different. And the solution in Psalm 49, and it's mostly a psalm, is two things. One is negative, one is positive. The first one that's negative, and I've already kind of mentioned it, is that death, usually we see it as a problem. It absolutely is. I don't want to treat death romantically. We should cry and weep and grieve at Christians' funerals. We should not treat death in some spiritualized way. But nonetheless, in a very real way, taking death seriously will be a profoundly strategic advantage to you as a Christian in resisting the pull of the crowd. Because as you pay attention to it, you will see that every person whose opinion just hangs over you with heaviness and impact and influence, that their long-term destination, the long-term real estate attached to their name, is going to be a plot in a cemetery, not in Manhattan, but in Queens. That's where every rich person in Manhattan is going, a cemetery plot in Queens. And nobody is going to remember them in 100 years. And nobody is going to care about what they thought. And nothing they accomplished is going to matter anymore. And this is the person whose approval is the great shaping force in your life right now? That, to put it this way, the psalmist sees, and wisdom literature always does this, it encourages us to take the long view. The writer sees that in the lives, in the stories of those who look successful, those who have pomp and prestige, who glitter and glow in our eyes, that very soon a profound disruption is coming in their story. A profound intervention. And they will be buried. And they, no matter how much money they have, no matter how much everyone hangs on their word, no matter how much they shape the dictates and the moral sense and the common sense of society, that they are utterly helpless to help themselves out of this predicament. Ransom is a language they usually connect to the cross, and we'll do it in a few minutes with the Lord's Supper. But the idea here is that there is no amount in your bank account, there is no status in the eyes of human beings where you can pay a ransom to get yourself out of this fate. There is a profoundly humbling, even humiliating reality to all of us. And this is not to pick on rich people or strong people. This is true of all of us. Just to say, you're not usually tempted to care too much about what poor people think about you. And you're not tempted to care about what the loser in third grade thinks over there. But you are tempted to care about what the bully and the popular kids and the prom kings and the prom queens care about. And their fate is the same as everybody else's. Why would you envy them? Why would you be afraid of them? Why would you see the prosperity that seems to be connected to their going away from God's ways and their iniquity? Why would you think that that somehow matters? In Hebrews 2, there is a profound interpretation of the death and resurrection of Jesus, where in Hebrews 2, we're told that Jesus has come to deliver those who, through the fear of death, are subjected to lifelong slavery. We don't turn away from death because we're just not taking it into account, or because we are turning away from it, because it is the one thing that calls into question every other aspect of our lives. And Jesus has actually come to liberate us from the fear of death. But if you let the fear of death just constantly drive you, if you allow it to be moved to the horizon, moved to the margins, and you don't take it into account, then we will regularly make a mistake in whose voices we pay attention to, who we imitate, whose approval we care about. Stanley Hauerwas, I often quote this, a great ethicist and theologian who taught at Duke for a long time. He has this great line where he says, maybe the great American myth is that if you just live your life the right way, if you just go to the right schools, and in your 20s and in your 30s, establish yourself in Manhattan or Chicago or LA, and if you do this and if you do this, you need to hold the right beliefs, that you can get out of life alive. And you can't. None of us can get out of life alive. And all of the activity, all of the hustle and bustle, all of the outrage and all of the praise that happens in a culture is almost always not taking this into account. At the beginning of the book of Job, when everything falls apart for Job, even though he trusts in God, even though he seeks to honor God and love his neighbor, he reminds himself, naked I came into this world from my mother's womb, and naked and empty-handed I am going out of it. The Apostle Paul says that in 1 Timothy 6, why should we seek to live content and just care about honoring God and loving our neighbor and be content, not constantly be seeking the approval of others more or something else? Because we have brought nothing into this life with us, and we will take nothing with us out of it. Death is profoundly helpful if you pay attention to its reality in the Christian life. It will free you from 1,000 temptations that would otherwise be a lot stronger. It will help you to remember what really matters. It will help. So here is a question I have for you. So much of what passes for reality, for common sense, is actually stupid, according to Psalm 49, not just in our culture, but in every culture, every moment. And so for all of you, brothers and sisters, friends, are you able to see through the fog? Are you able to see through the hype? See through the facade? Are you able to see through the illusions, the delusions that are out there? Are you able to see that so much of what passes for reality is smoke and mirrors? Are you able to see that? Are you able to identify that and then step back and say, it actually doesn't matter to me all that much. This person who's going to be buried in Queens in 5 minutes for the next 5 billion years, how much he likes or dislikes me, that actually doesn't matter too much. As we come to a close, I want you to turn with me to one other passage, Isaiah 14. Psalm 49 is very individualistic, but the people of God, Israel, in the Old Testament learned this lesson through the corporate history they had as a people. And in Isaiah 14, this is just a couple of books after the Psalms, there is a passage that is almost certainly connected to Psalm 49. Whether Psalm 49 is first and gave rise to Isaiah 14 or the other way, I have no idea. But there is a passage that is very connected to Psalm 49 here. We need to notice that above Isaiah 13, it says, probably in your Bible is a subheading, the judgment on Babylon. If you remember anything about the Old Testament, remember Babylon are the guys with power. They're the guys with prestige. They're the guys that everybody else in the ancient world cares about, let's say on their good side, not on their bad side, and who did horrific things to Israel. And in Isaiah 14, after judgment has been announced that it's coming in the future on Babylon, let's look at chapter 14 of Isaiah, starting in verse 9. It's addressing Babylon and its leaders directly. And it says, Sheol beneath you is stirred up to meet you when you come. It rouses the shades, other former prom kings and prom queens from centuries ago who are also buried in Queens, they're also getting up to greet you when you come down to the cemetery. All who were once leaders, prestigious people in society, it raises from their thrones all who once were long ago kings of the earth. And all of them will answer and say to you, you too have now become as weak as we are. You have become like us, your pomp. Same word as Psalm 49, your pomp has been brought low to Sheol. The sound of your harps, maggots are laid as a bed beneath you, and worms are your covers. This is often taken as a passage about the fall of Satan, but it's actually about Babylon. How are you fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn? How are you cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low? You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. That is, I'm not only immortal, I am playing the role in the universe that God plays. That's how the average human being who's successful walks through their 60 or 70 years. In the future of that, verse 15, is that you have now been brought down to Sheol, to the far reaches of the pit. Those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man who once made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities, who did not let his prisoners go home? All the kings of the nations now lie buried in glory, each in his own tomb. But you are cast out away from your grave like a loathed branch. It says, even right now, while these people are still roaming the world, do you see what's coming? Do you see that this reversal is coming? So going back to Psalm 49, and I'll end with this. This might sound really negative, and in a sense it really is, but it's true. It's real. But Psalm 49, even more than this, gives us a second answer to the riddle. And it's in verse 15. Whereas these people, no matter how wealthy, how powerful, how popular, how glittery they are with prestige and honor in a society, they cannot ransom themselves or give to God anything to extend their life. The word ransom shows up again later in the psalm. Verse 15. I who am not rich, I who am not popular, I who am not powerful, I who people do not try to emulate and think, I want to be like this guy who's sacrificing and denying himself for the sake of God and often on the margins of society as he trusts in God rather than in wealth. Nobody looks at this person and says, this is who I want to be. Nonetheless, God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. And just one thing, I encourage you to notice this for later. The word there for he will receive me is the same verb that is used of Enoch being taken up by God at the beginning of the book of Genesis, the same word that is used of Elijah being taken up by God, the same word that is used by Jesus being taken up by God, the same word that is used just a little while later in Psalm 73. And we'll end the service here in a few minutes. You will probably remember this because this is, I think, one of the most famous parts of the Psalms. At the end of Psalm 73, after wrestling with just the impact and the influence that the foolish and the wicked have on the people of God, and just I was envying the wicked, I was thinking that I was wasting my time trying to trust in God, the psalmist says, "You guide me with your counsel, and afterwards you will receive me into glory." The same verb from Psalm 49, "Whom have I in heaven but you? In God, there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, and they will, because it's not just the rich who die, but also the poor. And it's not just the strong who die, but also the weak. You will also die. I will also die. Our flesh and our heart will fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. And he will ransom me from Sheol, and he will receive me." Do you believe this? Do you think that this is reality? If you do, live in light of it. Take it seriously. Actually, think about how you would respond differently to the world. I don't know if Arturo's here today, but Arturo and I have often talked about this. The first time I said this years ago, and this is not mine. I got this from a pastor of mine. John Piper is a pastor that some of you might recognize that name. And he said this a while ago, that even American Christians, we can invest. If you're an American Christian, you can invest a lot in Western civilization, America, the economy, whatever it is. And John Piper had this line when he said, the reality is that the United States of America will one day be a footnote in the archives of the new creation. Empires rise and fall. Nathaniel Hawthorne said, families are always rising and falling in America. Individuals too. But against the church, the gates of not hell, that's actually a bad translation. The gates of Hades, the gates of death will not prevail against the church. If you belong to Jesus, you are in the strongest position possible. You are in the wealthiest position possible. You are in the best position possible. Why would you be afraid in times of trouble of what other people who are doomed to die and who will not be ransomed from death think about you? This is what this psalm reminds us of. As we end, I send this out by email if you're on our email list. Tim Keller's memorial service was this past week. He died about 3 months ago now. And if you haven't watched it yet, I encourage you to watch it. And he designed, weeks, months before he died, the bulletin to his own funeral service. Every element in the order of worship he designed. And I was so stunned and overwhelmed, in a good way, I think, by the first page of the bulletin that Tim Keller designed for his own funeral was these two quotes. The first quote is a poem from George Herbert. "And in his blessing, God's blessing, you art blessed. For where thou only wert before, an executioner at best," he's talking about death here. Before Jesus came, death was only an executioner at best. That's all it was. "But now, O death, you are a gardener now, and more, an usher to convey souls beyond the utmost stars and poles." That death actually leads us into God's presence. It's not, even though it is a threat, even though it is sad, it is not primarily a threat anymore. And then Dwight L. Moody, one of the great evangelists in American history, this is the other quote Keller had there, said towards the end of his life, "Someday, friends, you will read in the papers that D.L. Moody of East Northfield is dead. Don't you believe a word of it. At that moment, I shall be more alive than I am now. I shall have gone up even higher." Do you believe this? Do you believe this? Your fears towards other people, your envy towards other people will begin to profoundly change. John Piper, years ago, when I was in grad school in Minnesota, I noticed that he had this on his wall. It's not a great poem. It's kind of corny, and it certainly can be cliched, but he had this on it in his home on the wall, and I just want to share it with you, and he was reminded of it every day. "There is only one life, and it will soon be passed. Only what is done for Christ will last." Do you believe this? "But God will ransom my soul from Sheol, and he will receive me." even though no human being can give a ransom for their life and everyone is helpless in the face of death, if you don't deny death, if you see that there is a great reversal coming, and as we end, I want to exhort you, comfort you, challenge you, remind you of this, that the first will be last and the last will be first. Those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Those who seek to save their own lives and accumulate as much as they can get and fulfill as many desires as they can will turn up naked and empty at the end. Those who give their lives away for the sake of the gospel, no matter how much cost there is, will save their lives. This is central to the gospel. And so as Jesus says, as Psalm 49 says, do not be afraid of human beings. Do not be afraid of human beings. Remember that you belong to God. Let's pray, and then let's go to the Lord's table.